It's the Anne Franks that changed culture and mindsets. And I realized that her diary, even the way she wrote her diary, because she writes early in there, she starts out writing it like a diary, and then she quickly, you know, turns it into a friend that she names Kitty. And she specifically says, I'm going to start writing to dear Kitty because it's not about me talking to myself. She wanted a relationship. And I realized that she had actually taught me how I am a marketer to people, which is I'm always looking for the invisible people and bringing their stories to life.
23 years ago, Exchange alumni, writer, and marketing company founder Stephanie Zong traveled to Hong Kong, where she not only discovered her true calling, but she also got an inside look into the cultural revolution in China from her surrogate family. As a Chinese American, Stephanie had what she calls her Joy Luck Club moment before her international exchange when she lived in Taiwan. But it was a pivotal moment on her exchange experience and a realization about Anne Frank that shifted the course of her life, from seeking out a professorship to lifting up the voices of others with her own marketing company. Everyone has a story to tell. People, places, and international exchange. Join us to hear the extraordinary stories of exchange alumni and how their lives have been forever changed. This is Voices of Exchange.
So I was in graduate school at the time. I was at UCLA. I was on the track to be a professor. That was my dream job. And I was sitting in a class, and my professor said something that just literally lit up this idea in me of, I got to go to Hong Kong. I have to chronicle these stories of what's happening culturally there. And then when I met up with my professor at office hours and I told her my kooky idea, she said, you need to apply for a Fulbright. And so that's basically what I did. You know, I'd heard about Fulbrights before. And the truth was, I thought to myself, I'm not qualified. I know that I was looking at some statistics that they were showing of how many applications per country, per territory. And I thought, well, everyone's going to go to Hong Kong this year. So I almost didn't apply. But you know, I went for it and they chose me. And then next thing you know, I'm on an 18-hour flight to Hong Kong for the first time in my life. To put it in context, I'm 26 years old. It's my third time abroad. I had gone on exchange for a month in high school to the UK. And then at 22, I had a Joy Luck Club moment where I was thinking, I need to understand who my parents are and where I come from. So I spent 2 years living in Taipei trying to discover myself. Okay. And then now I'm in grad school and now I'm on this research study project and I'm going to Hong Kong. And you're really like, since this was 23 years ago, I had to really think about what were those first 72 hours like. They were bustling and hectic. And it felt like Mission Impossible. Why? Because I only had 3 days to find a place to live. That was the first thing before I actually had to go on a family trip to Taiwan. And Hong Kong, if you've been to Hong Kong, at least back then for sure, and I'm sure it's still true now, the real estate market is a lot like New York or San Francisco. It's really, really tough to find an affordable apartment of any size bigger than a bathroom. So here I was, you know, I got plopped down in a city that is, you know, lit up in lights. It's open 24 hours. I don't know the place. I can barely read some of the signs that are up. I don't know what neighborhoods are around there. Everything is by subway. I've got all my gear, you know, packed up on my back. And there's so many people. It's just so densely packed. And, you know, even the subways, it's, you know, it's sort of like you're the sardine that's getting squeezed into the train. And you hope when your stop lands, you'll be able to get out of there. And so there was a lot of, I just went straight for some English papers and looked at the apartments and started making phone calls and jetting from this place to that place. And then realizing that the place, you know, was too small or had, you know, or was too far away of where I was going to be working. And it was just a mad dash. And I was with two other Fulbright folks. We had exchanged information beforehand. This is 1997, so the internet does not exist yet. So I want you to imagine that too. So this is no apartments.com. This is really like, go get the newspaper, take out a magic marker, circle the ones you can afford, of which there's only two out of maybe 38 postings that I can afford on my grant, you know, as a student. Go to those places. You're hiking up a hill that was like 3 miles long, and it's 98 degrees and 90% humidity. And I was house hunting with the other two Fulbrighters, and every place was a no-go. And until we landed on a place, it was at the top of the hill. This was the big hike. Basically, the first 2 days was nothing but house hunting and maybe getting a little bit of food and getting to know the other two Fulbrighters that I was house hunting with. On the third day, I called a woman who was looking for a roommate, and she had promised it to someone else. But the two of us on the call, we had this kind of connection, and she said, why don't you come see the place anyway? And if for some reason the other girl doesn't show up, you can have the place.
When Stephanie arrives at the apartment, she meets the woman looking for a roommate, a mother from Beijing with an 8-year-old daughter who has grown up in New Zealand, and discovers that they have something in common, loss. Stephanie had lost her father the year before, and Dawn, the mother, had lost her husband. The connection was not only instant, but would prove to be the foundation for her understanding of China and Hong Kong in the late 90s, as well as for her roommate's daughter's understanding of her family's past.
The 3 months in, we're a surrogate family doing a lot of things together. And I'm learning a lot about communist China from my roommate, Dawn, while we're in Hong Kong with a territory being returned back to China, and she had left China. You know, so I think one of the things I really appreciate about the international experience is, like, I was there for academic research, and I can share a little bit about the stories that came out of there as well too, and the opportunities I got because of the international exchange. And the same thing that happens when, as you know, as somebody who's living abroad, like, where you choose to live and who you choose to live with also helps you determine, like, how deep of an experience you're gonna have, you know. We were exchanging a lot of stories. I was hearing a lot of firsthand stories of what it was like to be a young girl growing up in the Cultural Revolution, firsthand from my roommate. And she was telling me stories about, we were sharing stories about how we both fell in love with books. And she, I still remember this, like, she was telling a story to me and her daughter at the same time. And her daughter grew up in New Zealand. She has no concept of communist China whatsoever. She had never heard these stories from her own mother. So Dawn was telling us about how she was maybe 13 years old and she had fallen in love with reading, but there was a lot of censorship going on. And so what was happening was, you know, a lot of books were getting confiscated, and her job in her home was, she was the one that took out the garbage, and all the garbage would end up in, you know, these houses would be in a square, like a quadrant of four houses with a courtyard in the middle, and everyone would dump their trash, you know, in the center. So there was, like, rotten lettuce, and this is what she would talk. I still remember this. Like, she talked about how she found one of their neighbors had been someone who had a library of books. And I want to say it was actually an American novel that was written in Chinese, but it was, like, shoved into the rotten lettuce. And she dug in there, and every time she took out the trash, she would, like, read a chapter when no one was looking and then shove it back. You know what I mean? Like, so that was how she was reading books. And I'm thinking about my experience as an American, and here I am going to the public library with stacks and stacks of books. My mother's a librarian. We have TV, all these other things, you know. And she's talking about the literal stakes that she has to take just to read. And her daughter is rolling around on the floor laughing uncontrollably. She like totally can't handle the story that her mother's telling her, you know, because she grew up in New Zealand. And I was just watching them, you know, like she's hearing this stuff for the first time about her mom. She's never seen her mom in her communist life. And so these were the kinds of stories we were having every single night. And then we would go out together, you know. And so on the one hand, so part of my international experience was the surrogate family and what we're learning and talking about in real time about how we were each affected by our governments, how we're each affected by our cultures, and then what was happening in Hong Kong and what we were seeing. She was someone who, she was a young doctor in 1992 when Tiananmen Square happened. She was in Beijing when it happened, working in a hospital, and guess what? She didn't even know the massacre happened. You know when she found out about it? 4 years later when she immigrates to New Zealand and everyone finds out she's from Beijing and they ask her, oh my gosh, what was that like? And she's like, what are you talking about? And it was in her same city.
Stephanie had come to Hong Kong to capture people's stories during the political transition of Hong Kong to China, which was officially handed over by the British government on July 1st, 1997, after 156 years of British rule. In the United States, Stephanie had been studying comparative literature at UCLA, and she had thought, when she was starting her Fulbright, that she would become a professor in cross-cultural studies, drawing on her Chinese-American background. While the experience capturing stories and experiences in Hong Kong was powerful, a series of conversations the storyteller had would bring about a realization that changed the path of her life forever.
So on the one hand, at home, I was getting this exposure. And then out on my project, I was meeting writers and filmmakers and artists and photographers who were of Chinese descent, who were Hong Kong Chinese, but English is really their language. And they write and create art in English. And I had never been part of a writer's community before. I had never seen myself. You know, here I am, the closet writer, like I said, right? Like I was always writing in secret, like Emily Dickinson, like nobody knows I'm writing anything because who am I? I'm not a published writer. And here I am spending, I'm having lunches and I'm at the, there was this club where all the writers hung out at and I was interviewing people. They were saying yes to my interview requests and I am following their, you know, their lives for a year. And then I meet a professor, Alex Kuo, who's a Chinese American professor here in the States. And he is an American studies professor who was one of the, I mean, he was someone, you would study in an Asian American studies class. He was somebody who was part of the renaissance of Asian American literature in the 70s. And here he is on his grant. And we meet at one of these events. And then I start working with him to organize the first literary festival of Hong Kong Chinese writers writing in English. It was the first literary festival of Hong Kong Chinese writing written in English by Hong Kong Chinese writers. Still a mouthful. I went in pretty sure I was going to be a professor and live a Dead Poet Society kind of life. That was where I was at, right? And I had my lane of research that I wanted to bring to the table. And, you know, so Alex Kuo, the professor I worked with, I was honestly struggling in academia personally. There was something I was resisting and I couldn't figure out what it was. And one day, you know, we're in the middle of doing all the festival activities. And Alex, who is he's a professor, right? He's a tenured professor. And he looks at me and he says, Stephanie, I don't think you should be a professor. You don't want to be an academic. And it was the beginning of several conversations he had with me. He had felt really strongly about it. And I realized that those conversations, that he was right. In my heart, I love to teach. But I'm also somebody who cares deeply about social impact. It gets all the way back to reading Anne Frank's diary. I'm not just interested in stories. I mean, they're entertaining, but I want to be on the ground and I want to be affecting culture somehow, right? And building bridges. Like, fundamentally, I'm a storyteller. I'm a storyteller and I'm a bridge builder. And that's how I build bridges, is through stories. And so his come to Jesus conversation with me helped me take off probably a curtain of denial that I was really still trying to muscle through. So I knew by the time I came back to UCLA, I knew I was going to leave with a master's degree. And I knew I was going to do something that was a lot more hands-on. I knew I wanted to be a storyteller before I could write. I remember being around 3 or 4 years old and sitting at the coffee table with a pen and a piece of paper and pretending to write cursive. It's just a bunch. It looks like an EKG, right? It's just circles going up and down and loops in this. But I just really, there was something powerful in there. I very, very early on was really interested in other people's lives because of that. I was also really shy and terrified of people back then. So this is an elementary school. And so this, it was a place to retreat into where I could be myself and I could make friends and experience different worlds. And over time, basically around the time I was 12 years old, I had some allowance and I went to the bookstore with my dad and bought the first book that I ever had with my own money. And it was Anne Frank's Diary of a Young Girl. And I saw this girl's picture on the front. And if you see the picture, she looks like a tomboy, and she was a bit of a tomboy. You know, she has short hair and I was a tomboy. And I saw a girl looking back at me, you know, that reminded me of me. And I didn't know her story. I just knew it was a diary. And I was like, oh, this sounds interesting. And that book changed my life forever. And it began my journey as a writer and a storyteller. I was really devastated after creating this deep bond with her, you know, in her life. And then to find out that she died, at the hands of the Nazis. And that was quite traumatizing, as you might imagine. But the impression that she made on me was that here was this ordinary girl at 13 years old who owned her voice, who found her own experiences valuable in a country that did not value her. And that her words and her story, when she owned it, changed the world. And so I started a diary at that point, and I started really realizing I could write for myself. And I wrote for myself in hiding for a very, very long time, just for me. And then when I got into my 20s, like I said, I've had so many people tell me fascinating stories where on the outside, you might make an assumption about them. And then they tell you this other story. And suddenly, you know, everything goes technicolor and what you thought you believed about the world or people changes. And I've had so many experiences like that, that to me, my favorite thing, and it's still true today in my work, and in my personal life, always, I was that person that was fascinated by people's stories. I'm that person that people tell their life story to on a subway, you know, hold family secrets that they never told anybody else. And I felt like, you know, I wanted to learn something about myself. And I also wanted to be there to capture as many stories as possible and then be able to step back and look at these stories side by side and see what we can learn about, you know, ourselves as a civilization.
After her international exchange in Hong Kong, Stephanie returned to the US and got involved with a company venturing into the emerging world of online education. There, she fell in love with content creation and marketing. She later joined Teach for America as a marketing director, where she discovered a study that revealed what she perhaps had known instinctively all along: that storytelling can change the world.
when I found that study in 2012, I was like, ding, 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 ding. Like, this is the lane specifically I need to be in. And I evangelized that with Teach for America for 2 years. And then I left because I wanted to help small, medium-sized change-making organizations tap storytelling if you don't have a Super Bowl budget. The first name of the company was called Create Groundswell because that's what I wanted to do, but my spirit wasn't in it. And this is part of my story. I was as much as I was passionate about this, I was a shy person and hiding out in my business. And it took me 2 years to get my website off the ground because you're like, it has to be perfect. And people don't understand what you do because you're trailblazing and you're doing this thing. And literally the day before I launched my website, I do one more Google search. And 6 months prior, another company in Los Angeles is called Groundswell Studio, and they're doing marketing stuff. And instead of seeing that as a major setback, which probably would have been the way I normally would think as a perfectionist, I was like, that wasn't meant to be your company anyway. You chose it because you needed to get out of the gate, right, with something, and it's not meant for you. And I did some soul searching, which is part of what I help entrepreneurs do, right? And so I spent a month and I took myself through some exercises that I would do as a journalist and as a podcast producer and, you know, marketing director, all these things to figure out what is the essence of this company I'm building and who am I really? And I looked, after I wrote down, I remembered Anne Frank, and then I looked on my bookshelf and there's the diary. And then suddenly I realized, oh my gosh, this book has been with me everywhere I've gone. It was the book that went with me to England when I was in high school. It was the book that went with me to Taiwan. And I couldn't bring a lot of books with me to Taiwan, but it was there. It was like a talisman. Like, she was with me all along. She was with me in Hong Kong. She has literally been with me everywhere. And I realized then when I connect the dots backwards, right, I realized, okay, the way I do marketing and the way I do storytelling is I believe it's not about a top-down approach where it's like, let's listen to the CEO and the founder and how great they are. And let's find out this institution was created in this date and year. It's not that. It's who are the hidden heroes in your organization and your story, right? And so it's the Anne Franks we want to hear from. It's the Anne Franks that changed culture and mindsets. And I realized that her diary, even the way she wrote her diary, because she writes early in there, she starts out writing it like a diary and then she quickly, you know, turns it into a friend that she names Kitty. And she specifically says, I'm going to start writing to Dear Kitty because it's not about me talking to myself. She wanted a relationship. And I realized that she had actually taught me how I am a marketer to people, which is I'm always looking for the invisible people and bringing their stories to life and their agency. They're the ones we want to hear from. They're the ones whose transformation moves us to donate, right? Or to take a step forward in our lives the way somebody else has. And so Dear Anne Media is the name of my company in tribute to Anne Frank. And the deer is very important because it's always a reminder that marketing is not pushing a message. It is about creating a community in a two-way conversation. I really believe this. I believe every single person who is a professional wanting to make a difference, you're going to make a bigger difference when you own your difference and you have to understand it. And the International Exchange is one of the most different things you've done. Not to mention immerse yourself in difference. And it's made you a more innovative thinker. It's made you more creative. It's made you more empathetic. You have stories to tell in there that can be translated into your work experience in ways that add value that your employer or your client would never have thought of on their own.
Thank you, Stephanie Zong, for sharing your story and the power of storytelling with us. And thank you, our listeners, for coming along on the journey. Each episode, we strive to bring you inspiring stories from our global network of exchange alumni. Have an international exchange story yourself? Have any questions or suggestions? Email us at voicesofexchange@state.gov or reach out to us on Instagram at Voices of Exchange. We would love to hear from you. You can also find out more information on our alumni and our global network at alumni.state.gov. This is Voices of Exchange.